I know about you. I'll admit we pulled your files, we checked you out. Hell, but to do that, all we had to do was read the newspapers back then. You and that Dollmaker thing. So I know what you have been through with the internal people, and this isn't going to help, but it was Rourke's decision. What other things did he tell? He told the truth. He said both your name and Meadows's had come up in our investigation. He said you both knew each other. He asked that you be taken off the case, so all of this doesn't matter. Bosch looked off out of the booth. I want to hear you answer, he said. Am I a suspect?
No.
At least you weren't until you walked in this morning. Now, I don't know. I'm trying to be honest. I mean, you have to look at this from our standpoint. One guy we looked at last year comes in and says he's investigating the murder of another guy we looked very hard at. This first guy says, let me see your files.
She didn't have to tell him as much as she had. He knew this, and knew she was probably going out on a limb saying anything at all. For all the shit he had just stepped in or been put in, Harry Bosch was beginning to like cold, hard Eleanor Wish. If you won't tell me about Meadows, tell me one thing about myself. You said I was looked at and then dropped. How'd you clear me? You go to Mexico?
That and other things.
She looked at him a moment before going on.
You were cleared early on.
At first we got excited. I mean, we looked through the files of people with tunnel experience in Vietnam, and there sitting on the top was the famous Harry Bosch, detective superstar, a couple of books written about his cases, TV movie, a spin-off series, and the guy the newspapers just happened to have been filled with, the guy whose star crashed with a one-month suspension and transfer from the elite robbery homicide division to...
She hesitated. The sewer. He finished it for her. She looked down into her glass and continued.
So, right away, Rourke started figuring that maybe that's how you spent your time, digging this tunnel into the bank. From hero to heel, this was your way to get back at society, something crazy like that. But when we backgrounded you and asked around quietly, we heard you went down to Mexico for the month. We sent someone down to Ensenada and checked it out. You were clear. Around then, we also had gotten your medical files from the VA up at Sepulveda.
Oh, that's it. That's who you checked with this morning, isn't it?
He nodded. She continued.
Anyway, in the medical, there were the psychiatrist's reports. I'm sorry, this seems like such an invasion.
I want to know.
The therapy for PTS. I mean, you are completely functional, but you have infrequent manifestation of post-traumatic stress in forms of insomnia and other things, claustrophobia. A doctor even wrote once that you wouldn't go into a tunnel like that never again. Anyway, we put a profile of you through our behavioral sciences lab in Quantico. They discounted you as a suspect, said it was unlikely that you would cross the line for something like financial gain.
She let all of that sink in a few moments. Those VA files are old, Bosch said. The whole story is old. I'm not going to sit here and present a case for why I should be a suspect, but that VA stuff is old. I haven't seen a shrink, VA or otherwise, in 5 years. And as far as that phobia shit goes, I went into a tunnel to look at Meadows yesterday. What do you think your shrinks in Quantico would write about that? He could feel his face turn red with embarrassment. He had said too much. But the more he tried to control and hide it, the more blood rushed into his face. The wide-hipped waitress chose that moment to come back and freshen his coffee.
Ready to order?
She said.
No,
Wish said without taking her eyes off Bosch.
Not yet. Hon, we have a big lunch crowd come in here, and we're going to need the table for people what want to eat. I make my living off the hungry ones, not the ones too angry to eat.
She walked away with Bosch thinking that waitresses were probably better observers of human behavior than most cops. Wish said,
I am sorry about all of this. You should have let me get up when I first wanted to.
The embarrassment was gone, but the anger was still there. He wasn't looking out of the booth anymore, he was looking right at her. You think you know me from some papers in a file? You don't know me. Tell me what you know.
I don't know you. I know about you, she said.
She stopped a moment to gather her thoughts.
You are an institutional man, Detective Bosch. Your whole life. Youth shelters, foster homes, the army, then the police. Never leave the system. One flawed societal institution after another.
She sipped some water and seemed to be deciding whether to go on. She did.
Hieronymus Bosch,
The only thing your mother gave you was the name of a painter dead 500 years. But I imagine the stuff you've seen would make the bizarre stuff of dreams he painted look like Disneyland. Your mother was alone. She had to give you up. You grew up in foster homes, youth halls. You survived that, and you survived Vietnam, and you survived the police department. So far, at least. But you are an outsider in an insider's job. You made it to RHD and worked the headline cases, but you were an outsider all along. You did things your way, and eventually they busted you out for it.
She emptied her glass, seemingly to give Bosch time to stop her from continuing. He didn't.
It only took one mistake, she said. You killed a man last year. He was a killer himself, but that didn't matter. According to the reports, you thought he was reaching under a pillow on the bed for a gun. Turned out he was reaching for his toupee. Almost laughable. But IAD found a witness who said she told you beforehand that the suspect kept his hair under the pillow. Since she was a street whore, her credibility was in question. It wasn't enough to bounce you, but it cost you your position. Now you work Hollywood, the place most people in the department call the sewer.
Her voice trailed off. She was finished. Bosch didn't say anything, and there was a long period of silence. The waitress cruised by the booth, but knew better than to speak to them. When you get back to the office, he finally began, you tell Rourke to make one more call. He got me off the case, he can get me back on.
I can't do it. He won't do it.
Yes, he'll do it. And tell him he has until tomorrow morning to do it.
Oh, what? What can you do? I mean, let's be honest. With your record, you'll probably be suspended by tomorrow. As soon as Pounds got off the phone with Rourke, he probably called IAD if Rourke didn't do it himself.
Doesn't matter. Tomorrow morning, I hear something, or tell Rourke he'll be reading a story in the Times about how an FBI suspect in a major bank heist, a subject of FBI surveillance, no less, was murdered right under the Bureau's nose, taking with him the answers to the celebrated Westland Tunnel caper. All the facts might not be right or in the correct order, but it'll be close enough. More important than that, it will be a good read, and it'll make waves all the way to D.C. It'll be embarrassing, and it'll also be a warning to whoever did Meadows. You'll never get them then. And Rourke will always be known as the guy who let them get away. She looked at him, shaking her head as if she were above this whole mess.
It's not my call. I'll have to go back to him and let him decide what to do. But if it was me, I'd call your bluff. And I will tell you straight out, that's what I'll tell him to do.
It's no bluff. You've checked me out. You know I'll go to the media, and the media will listen to me and like it. Be smart. You tell him it's no bluff. I'll have nothing to lose by doing it. He'll have nothing to lose by bringing me in.
He began to slide out of the booth. He stopped and threw a couple of dollar bills on the table.
You've got my file. You know where you can reach me.
Yes, we do,
she said, and then, hey, Bosch? He stopped and looked back at her.
The street whore. Was she telling the truth about the pillow?
Don't they all? Bosch parked in the lot behind the station on Wilcox and smoked right up until he reached the rear door. He killed a butt on the ground and went in, leaving behind the odor of vomit that wafted from the mesh windows at the rear of the station holding tank. Jerry Edgar was pacing in the back hall waiting for him.
Harry, we've got a fourth whiff from 98.
Yeah? What about?
I don't know, but he's been coming out of the glass box every 10 minutes looking for you. You got your beeper and the Motorola turned off, and I saw a couple of the IAD silks up from downtown go in there with him a while ago.
Bosch nodded without saying anything comforting to his partner.
What's going on? Edgar blurted. If we've got a story, let's get it straight before we go in there. You've had experience with this shit, not me.
I'm not sure what's going on. I think they're kicking us off the case. Me, at least. He was very nonchalant about the whole thing.
Harry, they don't bring IAD in to do that. Something's on, and man, I hope whatever you did, you didn't fuck me up, too.
Edgar immediately looked embarrassed.
Sorry, Harry. I didn't mean it that way.
Relax. Let's go see what the man wants. Bosch headed toward the detective squad room. Edgar said he'd cut through the watch office and then come in from the front hall so it wouldn't look like they had collaborated on a story. When Bosch got to his desk, the first thing he noticed was that the blue murder book on the Meadows case was gone. But he also noticed that whoever had taken it had missed the cassette tape with the 911 call on it. Bosch picked up the cassette and put it in his coat pocket, just as 98's voice boomed out of the glass office at the head of the squad room. He yelled just one word.
Bosch!
The other detectives in the squad room looked around. Bosch got up and slowly walked toward the glass box, as the office of Lieutenant Harvey, 98 Pounds, was called. Through the windows, he could see the backs of two suits sitting in there with Pounds. Bosch recognized them as the two IAD detectives who had handled the Dollmaker case, Lewis and Clark. Edgar came into the squad through the front hallway just as Bosch passed, and they walked into the glass box together. Pounds sat dull-eyed behind his desk. The men from Internal Affairs did not move.
"First thing, no smoking, Bosch. You got that?"
Pounds said.
"In fact, the whole squad stunk like an ashtray this morning. I'm not even going to ask if it was you."
Department and city policy outlawed smoking in all community-shared offices, such as squad rooms. It was okay to smoke in a private office if it was your office, or if the office's occupant allowed visitors to smoke. Pounds was a reformed smoker, and militant about it. Most of the 32 detectives he commanded smoked like junkies. When 98 wasn't around, many of them would go into his office for a quick fix, rather than have to go out to the parking lot, where they'd miss phone calls and where the smell of piss and puke migrated from the rear windows of the drunk tank. Pounds had taken to locking his office door, even on quick trips up the hall to the station commander's office, but anybody with a letter opener could pop the door in 3 seconds. The lieutenant was constantly returning and finding his office space fouled by smoke. He had 2 fans in the 10-by-10 room and a can of Glade on the desk. Since the frequency of the fouling had increased with the reassignment of Bosch from Parker Center to Hollywood Detectives, 98 Pounds was convinced Bosch was the major offender, and he was right. But he had never caught Bosch in the act.
"Is that what this is about?" Bosch asked. "Smoking in the office?"
"Just sit down,"
Pounds snapped. Bosch held his hands up to show there were no cigarettes between his fingers. Then he turned to the 2 men from Internal Affairs.
"Well, Jed, it looks like we might be off on a Lewis and Clark expedition here. I haven't seen the great explorers on the move since they sent me on a no-expense-paid vacation to Mexico. Did some of their finest work on that one. Headlines, sound bites, the whole thing. The stars of Internal Affairs."
The 2 IAD cops' faces immediately reddened with anger.
"This time you might do yourself a favor and keep your smart mouth shut," Clark said. "You're in serious trouble, Bosch. You get it?"
"Yeah, I get it.
Thanks for the tip. I got one for you, too. Go back to the leisure suit you used to wear before you became Irving's bendover. You know, the yellow thing that matched your teeth? The polyester does more for you than the silk. In fact, one of the guys out there in the bullpen mentioned that the ass end of that suit is getting shiny, all the work you do riding a desk."
All right," Pounds cut in. "Bosch, Edgar, sit down and shut up for a minute. This lieutenant, I didn't say one thing," Edgar began. "Shut up! Everybody! Shut up a minute!" Pounds barked. "Jesus Christ! Edgar, for the record, these 2 are from Internal Affairs, if you didn't already know. Detectives Lewis and Clark. What this is..."
"I want a lawyer," Bosch said.
"Me too, I guess," added Edgar.
"Oh, bullshit," Pounds said. "We're going to talk about this and get some things straight, and we aren't bringing any Police Protective League bullshit into it. If you want a lawyer, you can get one later. Right now, you're going to sit here, the both of you, and answer some questions. If not, Edgar, you are going to be bounced out of that $800 suit and back into uniform. And Bosch, shit, Bosch, you'll probably go down for the count this time."
For a few moments, there was silence in the small room, even though the tension among the 5 men threatened to shatter the windows. Pounds looked out at the squad room and saw about 12 detectives acting as if they were working, but who were actually trying to pick up whatever they could through the glass. Some had been attempting to read the lieutenant's lips. He got up and lowered a set of Venetian blinds over the windows. He rarely did this. It was a signal to the squad that this was big. Even Edgar showed his concern, audibly exhaling. Pounds sat back down. He tapped a long fingernail on the blue plastic binder that lay closed on his desk.
"Okay, now let's get down to it," he began. "You 2 guys are off the Meadows case. That's 1. No questions, you're done. Now, from the top, you're going to tell us anything and everything.
At that, Lewis snapped open a briefcase and pulled out a cassette tape recorder. He turned it on and put it on Pounds's spotless desk. Bosch had been partnered with Edgar only 8 months. He didn't know him well enough to know how he would take this kind of bullying, or how far he could hold out against these bastards, but he did know him well enough to know he liked him and didn't want him to get jammed up. His only sin in this whole thing was that he had wanted Sunday afternoon off to sell houses.
"This is bullshit," Bosch said, pointing to the recorder. "Turn that off," Pound said to Lewis, pointing to the recorder, which was actually closer to him than to Lewis.
The internal affairs detective stood up and picked up the recorder. He turned it off, hit the rewind button, and replaced it on the desk. After Lewis sat back down, Pound said,
"Jesus Christ, Bosch. The FBI calls me today and tells me they've got you as a possible suspect in a goddamn bank heist. They say this Meadows was a suspect in the same job, and by virtue of that, you should now be considered a suspect in the Meadows kill. You think we aren't going to ask questions about that?"
Edgar was exhaling louder now. He was hearing this for the first time.
"Keep the tape off and we'll talk," Bosch said.
Pounds contemplated that for a moment and said,
"For now, no tape. Tell us."
"First off, Edgar doesn't know shit about this. We made a deal yesterday. I take the Meadows case and he goes home. He does the wrap-up on Spivey, the TV stabbed the night before. This FBI stuff, the bank job, he doesn't know for shit. Let him go."
Pounds seemed to make a point of not looking at Lewis or Clark or Edgar. He'd make this decision on his own. It produced a slight glimmer of respect in Bosch, like a candle set out in the eye of a hurricane of incompetence. Pounds opened his desk drawer and pulled out an old wooden ruler. He fiddled with it with both hands. He finally looked at Edgar.
"That right, what Bosch says?"
Edgar nodded.
"You know, it makes him look bad, like he was trying to keep the case for himself, conceal the connections from you."
"He told me he knew Meadows. He was up front all the way. It was a Sunday. We weren't going to get anybody to come out and take it off us on account of him knowing the guy 20 years ago. Besides, most of the people who end up dead in Hollywood, the police had known one way or the other. This stuff about the bank and all, he must have found out after I left. I'm finding it all out sitting here."
"Okay," Pound said. "You got any of the paper on this one?"
Edgar shook his head.
"Okay, finish up what you've got on the, what'd you call it? Spivey, yeah, the Spivey case. I'm assigning you a new partner. I don't know who, but I'll let you know. Okay, go on, that's all."
Edgar let out one more audible breath and stood up. Harvey, 98, Pounds, let things settle in the room for a few moments after Edgar left. Bosch wanted his cigarette badly, even to just hold one unlit in his mouth, but he wouldn't show them such a weakness.
"Okay, Bosch," Pounds began. "Anything you want to tell us about all this?"
"Yeah, it's bullshit."
Clark smirked. Bosch paid no mind. But Pounds gave the IAD detective a withering look that further increased his stock of respect with Bosch.
"The FBI told me today I was no suspect," Bosch said. "They looked at me 9 months ago because they looked at anybody around here who'd worked the tunnels in Vietnam. They found some connection to the tunnels back there. Simple as that. It was good work. They had to check out everybody. So they looked at me and went on. Hell, I was in Mexico, thanks to these two goons, when the bank thing went down. The FBI just supposedly," Clark said.
"Shove it, Clark. You're just angling for a way to take your own vacation down there at taxpayers' expense checking it out. You can check with the Bureau and save the money."
Bosch then turned back to Pounds and adjusted his chair so his back was to the IAD detectives. He spoke in a low voice to make it clear he was talking to Pounds, not them.
"The Bureau wants me off it because, one, I threw a curve at him when I showed up there today to ask about the bank caper. I mean, I was a name from the past, and they panicked and called you. And two, they want me off the case because they probably fucked it up when they let Meadows skate last year. They blew their one chance at him and don't want an outside department to come in and see that or to break the thing they couldn't break for 9 months."
"No, Bosch, that's what's bullshit," Pound said. "This morning I received a formal request from the assistant special agent in charge who runs their bank squad, a guy named Rourke.
You know him? Well, he asked that I be removed from the Meadows case forthwith. He says I knew Meadows, who just happened to be the prime suspect in the bank job. He ends up dead, and I'm on the case. Coincidence? Rourke thinks not. I'm not sure myself. That's what he said. So that's where we start. Tell us about Meadows, how you knew him, when you knew him. Don't leave one thing out.
Bosch spent the next hour telling Pounds about Meadows, the tunnels, the time Meadows called after almost 20 years, and how Bosch got him into VA outreach in Sepulveda without ever seeing him, just phone calls. At no time did Bosch address the IAD detectives or acknowledge that they were even in the room.
I didn't make it a secret that I knew him, he said at the end. I told Edgar. I walked right in and told the FBI. You think I would have done that if I was the one who did Meadows? Not even Lewis and Clark are that dumb.
Well, then, Jesus Christ, Bosch, why didn't you tell me? Pounds boomed. Why isn't it in the reports, in this book? Why do I have to hear it from the FBI? Why does Internal Affairs have to hear it from the FBI?
So Pounds hadn't made the call to IAD. Rourke had. Bosch wondered if Eleanor Wish had known that, and had lied, or if Rourke called out the goons on his own. He hardly knew the woman. He didn't know the woman, but he found himself hoping she hadn't lied to him.
I only started the reports this morning, Bosch said. I was going to bring them up to date after seeing the FBI. Obviously, I didn't get the chance.
Well, I'm saving you the time, Pound said. It's been turned over to the FBI.
What has? The FBI has no jurisdiction over this. This is a murder case. Rourke said they believe the slaying is directly related to their ongoing investigation of the bank job. They will include this in their investigation. We will assign our own case officer through an interdepartmental liaison. If and when the time comes to charge someone in the murder, the appointed officer will take it to the DA for state charges.
Christ, Pounds, there is something going on. Don't you see that?
Pounds put the ruler back in the drawer and closed it.
Yes, something is going on, but I don't see it your way, he said.
That's it, Bosch. That's an order. You are off. These two men want to talk to you, and you are on a desk till Internal Affairs is finished with its investigation.
He was quiet a moment before beginning again in a solemn tone, a man unhappy with what he had to say.
You know, you were sent out here to me last year, and I could have put you anywhere. I could have put you on the goddamn burglary table, handling 50 reports a week, just buried you in paper. But I didn't. I recognized your skills and put you on homicide, what I thought you wanted. They told me last year that you're good, but you don't stay in the lines. Now I see they were right. How this will hurt me, I don't know. But I'm not worrying about what's best for you anymore. Now, you can either talk to these guys or not. I don't really care. But that's it. We're done, you and me. If somehow you ride this one out, you better see about getting a transfer, because you won't be on my homicide table anymore.
Pounds picked up the blue binder off his desk and stood up. As he headed out of the office, he said, I have to get somebody to take this over to the bureau. You men can have the office as long as you need it.
He closed the door and was gone. Bosch thought about it and decided he really couldn't fault Pounds for what he had said or done. He took out a cigarette and lit it.
Hey, no smoking, you heard the man, Lewis said.
Fuck off, Bosch said.
Bosch, you're dead, Clark said. We're going to toast your ass right this time. You aren't the hero you once were. No PR problems this time. Nobody's going to give a shit about what happens to you.
Then he stood up and turned the tape recorder back on. He recited the date, the names of the three men present, and the Internal Affairs case number assigned to the investigation. Bosch realized the number was about 700 higher than the case number from the internal investigation 9 months earlier that sent him to Hollywood. 9 months, and 700 other cops have been through the bullshit ringer, he thought. One day there will be no one left to do what it says on the side of every patrol car, to serve and protect.
Detective Bosch, Lewis took over then in a modulated, calm tone. We would like to ask you questions regarding the investigation of the death of William Meadows. Will you tell us of any past association with or knowledge you had of the decedent?
I refuse to answer any questions without an attorney present, Bosch said. I cite my right to representation under California's Policeman's Bill of Rights.
Detective Bosch, the department administration does not recognize that aspect of the Policeman's Bill of Rights. You are commanded to answer these questions, and if you do not, you will be subject to suspension and possible dismissal. Can you loosen these handcuffs, please? Bosch said.
What?
Lewis cried out, losing his calm, confident tone. Clark stood up and went to the tape recorder and bent over it. Detective Bosch is not handcuffed, and there are two witnesses here who can attest to that fact, he said.
Just the two that cuffed me, Bosch said, and beat me. This is a direct violation of my civil rights. I request that a union rep and my attorney be present before we continue.
Clark rewound the tape and turned the recorder off. His face was almost purple with anger as he carried it back to his partner's briefcase. It was a few moments before words came to either one of them. Clark said,
It's going to be a pleasure to do you, Bosch. We'll have the suspension papers on the chief's desk by the end of the day. You'll be assigned to a desk at Internal Affairs where we can keep an eye on you. We'll start with Cubo and work our way up from there, maybe even to murder. Either way, you're done in the department. You're over.
Bosch stood up, and so did the two IAD detectives. Bosch took a last drag on his cigarette, dropped it on the floor in front of Clark, and stepped on it, grinding it into the polished linoleum. He knew they would clean it up, rather than let Pounds know they had not controlled the interview or the interviewee. He stepped between them then, exhaled the smoke, and walked out of the room without saying a word. Outside, he heard Clark's barely controlled voice call out,
You stay away from the case, Bosch!
Avoiding the eyes that followed him, Bosch walked through the squad room and dropped into his seat at the homicide table. He looked across at Edgar, who was seated at his own space.
You did good, Bosch said. You should come out all right.
What about you?
I'm off the case, and those two assholes are going to put paper in on me. I've got the afternoon, and that's about it before I get the rod.
God damn.
The deputy chief in charge of IAD had to sign off on all relieved-of-duty orders and temporary suspensions. Stiffer penalties had to be recommended to a police commission subcommittee for approval. Lewis and Clark would go for a temporary rod for conduct unbecoming an officer, or Cubo, as it was known. Then they'd work on something stiffer to take to the commission. If the deputy chief signed an ROD on Bosch, he would have to be notified according to union regs. That meant in person or in a tape-recorded phone conversation. Once notification was made, Bosch could be assigned to a desk at IAD in Parker Center or to his home until the conclusion of the investigation. But as they had just promised, Lewis and Clark would go for assignment to IAD. That way they could put him on display, like a trophy.
You need anything from me on Spivey? He asked Edgar.
No, I'm set. I'm going to start typing it up if I can get a machine.
Did you happen to check, like I asked, on Meadows' job on the subway project?
Harry, you...
Edgar must have thought better of saying what he wanted to say.
Yeah, I checked it out. For what it's worth, they said they haven't had anyone named Meadows on the job. There is a Fields, but he's black and he was at work today. And Meadows probably wasn't working under any other name because they aren't running a midnight shift. The project is ahead of schedule, if you can believe that shit.
Edgar then called out,
I got dibs on this electric.
No way,
called back an auto's detective named Minkley.
I'm on deck with that one.
Edgar started looking around for another candidate. Late in the day, the typewriters in the office were like gold. There were a dozen machines for 32 detectives. That was, if you included the manual jobs and the electrics with nervous ticks like moving borders or jumpy space bars.
Okay, then, Edgar called out. I got dibs after you, Mink.
Then Edgar lowered his voice and turned to Bosch.
Who do you think you'll put me with?
Pounds? I don't know.
It was like guessing who your wife would marry after you punched the time clock for the last time. Bosch wasn't all that interested in speculating who would be partnered with Edgar. He said,
Listen, I have to do some things.
Sure, Harry. You need any help? Anything from me?
Bosch shook his head and picked up the phone. He called his lawyer and left a message. It usually took 3 messages before the guy would call back, and Bosch made a note to call again. Then he turned his Rolodex, got a number, and called the U.S. Armed Services Records Archive in St. Louis. He asked for a law enforcement clerk and got a woman named Jessie St. John. He put in a priority request for copies of all of Billy Meadows' military records. 3 days, St. John said. He hung up, thinking that he would never see the records. They'd come, but he wouldn't be in this office, at this table, on this case. Next he called Donovan at SID and learned there had been no latent prints on the needle kit found in Meadows' shirt pocket and only smears on the can of spray paint. The light brown crystals found in the straining cotton in the kit came back as 55% pure heroin, Asian blend. Bosch knew that most heroin dealt on the street and shot into the vein was about 15% pure. Most of it was tar heroin made by Mexicans. Somebody had given Meadows a very hot shot. In Harry's mind, that made the tox tests he was waiting for a formality. Meadows had been murdered. Nothing else from the crime scene was of much use, except Donovan mentioned that the freshly burned match found in the pipe was not torn from the matchbook in Meadows's kit. Bosch gave Donovan the address of Meadows's apartment and asked him to send a team out to process it. He said to check the matches in an ashtray on the coffee table against the book in the kit. Then he hung up, wondering if Donovan would send somebody before word spread that Bosch was off the case, or suspended. The last call he made was to the coroner's office. Sakai said he had made next of kin notification. Meadows's mother was still alive and was reached in New Iberia, Louisiana. She had no money to send for him or bury him. She hadn't seen him in 18 years. Billy Meadows would not be going home. L.A. County would have to bury him. What about the VA? Bosch asked. He was a veteran.
Right, I'll check it out,
Sakai said, and hung up. Bosch got up and took a small portable tape recorder from one of his drawers in the file cabinets. The bank of files ran along the wall behind the homicide table. He slipped the recorder into his coat pocket with the 911 tape and walked out of the squad room through the rear hallway. He went past the lockup benches and the jail down to the crash office. The tiny office was more crowded than the detective bureau. Desks and files for 5 men and a woman were crammed into a room no bigger than a second bedroom in a Venice apartment. Down one wall of the room was a row of 4-drawer file cabinets. On the opposite wall was the computer and teletype. In between were 3 sets of 2 desks, pushed side by side. The back wall had the usual map of the city with black lines detailing the 18 police divisions. Above the map were the top 10, color 8x10s of the 10 top assholes of the moment in Hollywood Division. Bosch noticed one was a morgue shot. The kid was dead, but still made the list. Now that's an asshole, he thought. And above the photos, black plastic letters spelled out, Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. Only Thelia King was in, sitting in front of the computer. That was what Bosch wanted. Also known as The King, which she hated, and Elvis, which she didn't mind, Thelia King was the crash computer jockey. If you wanted to trace a gang lineage or were just looking for a juvie floating somewhere around Hollywood, Elvis was the one to see. But Bosch was surprised she was alone. He looked at his watch. Just after 2, too early for the gang troops to be on the street. Where's everybody at?
Hey, boss, she said, looking away from the screen. Funerals. We got 2 different gangs, and I mean Warren tribes, planting homeboys in the same cemetery today up in the valley. They got all hands up there to make sure things stay cool.
And so why aren't you out there with the boys?
Just got back from court. So, before you tell me why you are here, Harry, why don't you tell me what happened in 98 Pounds' office today?
Bosch smiled. Word traveled faster through a police station than it did on the street. He gave her an abbreviated account of his time in the barrel and the expected battle with IAD.
Bosch, you take things too seriously, she said. Why don't you get yourself an outside gig, something to keep yourself sane, moving in the flow like your partner? Too bad that sucker's married. He's making 3 times selling houses on the side what we make busting heads full-time. I need a gig like that.
Bosch nodded. But too much going with the flow is heading us into the sewer, he thought, but didn't say. Sometimes he believed that he took things just right, and everybody else didn't take them seriously enough. That was the problem. Everybody had an outside gig.
What do you need? She said. I better do it now before they put your paper through. After that, you'll be a leper around here.
Stay where you are, he said, and then he pulled over a chair and told her what he needed from the computer. The crash computer had a program called GRIT, an acronym within an acronym, this one for Gang-Related Information Tracking. The program files contained the vitals on the 55,000 identified gang members and juvenile offenders in the city. The computer also tied in with the gang computer at the sheriff's department, which had about 30,000 of its own gangbangers on file. One part of the GRIT program was the moniker file. This stored references to offenders by their street names and could match them with real names, DOBs, addresses, and so on. All monikers that came to police attention through arrests or shake cards, field interrogation reports, were fed into the computer program. It was said that the grit file had more than 90,000 monikers in it. You just needed to know which keys to push. And Elvis did. Bosch gave her the three letters he had. "I don't know if that's the whole thing or a partial," he said. "I think it's a partial." She typed in the commands to open the grit files, put in the letters S-H-A, and hit the prompt key. It took about 13 seconds. A frown creased Thelia King's ebony face.
343 hits, she announced. "You might be hiding out here a while, hon."
He told her to eliminate the blacks and Latinos. The 911 tape sounded white to him. She pressed more keys, then the computer screen's amber letters recomposed the list.
"Mm-hmm, that's better than 19 hits, King said.
There was no moniker that was just the three letters, Shaw. There were five shadows, four Shaws, two Sharkies, E-Y-S, two Sharkies, I-E-S, and one each of Shark, Shabby, Shallow, Shank, Shabbat, and Shame. Bosch thought quickly about the graffito he had seen on the pipe up at the dam, the jagged S almost like a gaping mouth. The mouth of a shark? "Pull up the variations on shark," he said. King hit a couple of keys, and the top third of the screen filled with new amber letters. Shark was a valley boy. Limited contact with police. He had gotten probation and graffiti cleanup after he was caught tagging bus benches along Ventura Boulevard in Tarzana. He was 15. It wasn't likely he would have been up at the dam at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning, Bosch guessed. King pulled the first Sharky, i.e., up on the screen. He was currently in a Malibu fire camp for juvenile offenders. The second Sharky, i.e., was dead, killed in a gang war between the KGB, kids gone bad, and the Vineland boys in 1989. His name had not yet been purged from the computer records. When King called up the first Sharky, E.Y., the screen filled with information, and a blinking word at the bottom said, "More."
"Here's a regular troublemaker," she said.
The computer report described Edward Neese, a male white, 17 years of age, known to ride a yellow motorbike, tag number JVN138, and who had no known gang affiliation but used Sharky as a graffiti tag, a frequent runaway from his mother's home in Chatsworth. Two screens of police contacts with Sharky followed. Bosch could tell by the location of each arrest or questioning that this Sharky was partial to Hollywood and West Hollywood when he ran away. He scanned to the bottom of the second screen, where he saw a loitering arrest 3 months earlier at the Hollywood Reservoir. "This is him," he said. "Forget the last kid. Hard copy?" She pushed keys to print the computer file and then pointed to the wall of file cabinets. He went over and opened the end drawer. He found the file on Edward Neese and pulled it. Inside was a color booking photo. Sharky was blonde and seemed small in the picture. He had the look of hurt and defiance that was as common as acne on teenagers' faces these days. But Bosch was struck by a familiarity about the face. He couldn't place it. He turned the photo over. It was dated 2 years earlier. King handed him the computer printout, and he sat down at one of the empty desks to study it and the contents of the file. The most serious offenses the boy who called himself Sharky, E.Y., had committed and been caught at were shoplifting, vandalism, loitering, and possession of marijuana and speed. He had been held once, 20 days, at Sylmar Juvenile Hall after one of the drug arrests, but later released on home probation. All the other times he was popped, he was immediately released to his mother. He was a chronic runaway from home and a throwaway from the system. There was not much more in the file than was on the computer. A little elaboration on the arrests was all. Bosch shuffled through the papers until he found the report on the loitering charge. It went to pretrial intervention and was dismissed when Sharky agreed to go home to his mother and stay there. That apparently didn't last long. There was a report that the mother had reported him missing to his probation officer 2 weeks later. According to these records, he had not been picked up yet. Bosch read the investigating officer's summary on the loitering arrest. It said, I.O. interviewed Donald Smiley, a caretaker at the Mulholland Dam, who said at 7 a.m. this date he went into the pipe situated alongside the reservoir access road to clear it of debris. Smiley found the boy asleep on a bed made of newspapers. The boy was dirty and incoherent when roused. Subject appeared to be under the influence of narcotics. Police were called and I.O. responded. The arrestee stated to I.O. that he had been sleeping there regularly because his mother did not want him at home. I.O. determined the subject was a reported runaway and took him into custody this date, suspicion of loitering. Sharkey was a creature of habit, Bosch thought. He was arrested at the dam 2 months ago, but had gone back there to sleep Sunday morning. He looked through the rest of the papers in the file for indications of other habits that would help Bosch find him. From a 3x5 shake card, Bosch learned that Sharkey had been stopped and questioned, but not arrested, on Santa Monica Boulevard near West Hollywood in January. Sharkey was lacing up new Reeboks, and the officer, believing he might have just lifted them, asked Sharkey to produce a receipt. He did, and that would have been that. But when the boy pulled the receipt out of a leather pouch on his motorbike, the officer noticed a plastic bag in there and asked to see that as well. The bag contained 10 photographs of Sharkey. He was naked in each and stood in different poses, fondling himself in some, his penis erect in others. The officer took the photos and destroyed them, but noted on the shake card that he would alert the sheriff's station in West Hollywood that Sharkey was hustling photos to homosexuals on Santa Monica Boulevard. That was it. Bosch closed the file, but kept the photo of Sharkey. He thanked Thelia King and left the small office. He was walking through the station's rear hallway, past the lockup benches, when he placed the familiarity in the photo. The hair was longer now, and in dreadlocks, the defiance crowding out the hurt in the face, but Sharkey had been the kid who was cuffed to the juvie bench early that morning. Bosch felt sure of it. Thelia had missed it on the computer search because the arrest had not yet been logged in. Bosch cut into the watch commander's office, told the lieutenant what he was looking for, and was led to a box labeled AM Watch. Bosch looked through the reports stacked in the box until he found the paperwork on Edward Neese. Sharkey had been picked up at 4 a.m., loitering near a newsstand on Vine. A patrol officer thought he was hustling. After he grabbed him, he ran a computer check and learned he was a runaway. Bosch checked the day's arrest sheet and learned the kid had been held until 9 a.m. when his probation officer came and got him. Bosch called the P.O. at Sylmar Juvenile Hall, but learned that Sharkey had already been arraigned before a juvenile court referee and was released to the custody of his mother.
And that's his biggest problem. He'll be gone by tonight, back on the street, I guarantee it. And I told the ref that, but he wasn't going to book the kid into the monkey house just because he was caught loitering and his mother happens to be a telephone whore.
A what? Bosch asked.
It should be in the file. Yeah, while Sharky's on the street, dear old mom is at home telling guys on the phone how she's going to piss in their mouths and put rubber bands on their dicks. Advertises in skin mags. She gets $40 for 15 minutes. Takes MasterCard, Visa, puts them on hold while she checks on another line to make sure the number's valid and they get credit. Anyway, she's been doing it near as I can tell 5 years now. Edward's formative years were listening to this shit. I mean, no wonder the kid's a scammer and runner. What do you expect?
How long ago did he leave with her?
About noon. You want to catch him there, you better go. You got the address?
Yeah.
And, Bosch, one thing. Don't be expecting no whore when you get there. His mom, she doesn't look like the part she plays on the phone, if you know what I mean. Her voice might do the job, but her looks would scare a blind man.
Bosch thanked him for the warning and hung up. He took the 101 out to the valley and then the 405 north to the 118 and west. He got off in Chatsworth and drove into the rocky bluffs at the top corner of the valley. There was a condominium community built on what he knew was once a movie ranch. It had been one of the places Charlie Manson and his crew used to hide out. Parts of one member of that crew's body were supposedly still missing and buried around there someplace. It was near dusk when Bosch got there. People were off work and getting home. A lot of traffic on the development's thin roads, a lot of closing doors, a lot of calls to Sharkey's mother. Bosch was too late.
I have no time to talk to more police,
Veronica Neese said when she answered the door and looked at the badge.
As soon as I get him home, he is out the door again. I don't know where he goes. You tell me. That's your job. I have 3 calls waiting, 1 long distance. I gotta go.
She was in her late 40s, fat and wrinkled. She obviously wore a wig, and the dilation of her eyes did not match. She had the dirty socks smell of a speed addict. Her callers were better off with their fantasies, with just a voice with which to construct a body and face.
Mrs. Neese, I'm not looking for your son for something he did. I need to talk to him because of something he saw. He could possibly be in danger.
Oh, bullshit. I've heard that line before.
She closed the door and he just stood there. After a few moments, he could hear her on the phone, and he thought it was a French accent, but couldn't be sure. He could only make out a few of the sentences, but they made him blush. He thought about Sharky and realized he wasn't really a runaway, because there was nothing here to run away from. He left the doorstep and went back to the car. That would be it for the day. And he was out of time. Lewis and Clark must have paper out on him by now. He'd be assigned to a desk at IAD by morning. He drove back to the station and signed out. Everyone was already gone, and there were no messages on his desk, not even from his lawyer. On the way home, he stopped by the Lucky and bought 4 bottles of beer, a couple from Mexico, a lager from England called Old Nick, and a Henry's. He expected to find a message from Lewis and Clark on his phone tape when he got home. He wasn't wrong, but the message was not what he expected.
"I know you're there, so listen,"
said a voice Bosch recognized as Clark's.
"They can change their mind, but they can't change ours. We'll see you around."
There were no other messages. He played Clark's message over 3 times. Something had gone wrong for them. They must have been called off. Could his lame threat to the FBI to go to the media have worked? Even as he thought the question, he doubted the answer was yes. So then, what happened? He sat down in the watch chair and began drinking the beers, the Mexicans first, and looking through the war scrapbook he had forgotten to put away. When he had opened it Sunday night, he had opened a dark memory. He now found himself entranced by it, the distance of time having faded the threat as well as the photos. Sometime after dark, the phone rang, and Harry picked it up before the tape machine.
"Well,"
said Lieutenant Harvey Pounds,
"the FBI now thinks they might have been too harsh. They've reassessed and want you back in. You are to aid their investigation in any way they request. That comes down from administration, Parker Center."
Pounds's voice betrayed his astonishment at the reversal. "What about IAD?" Bosch asked.
"Nothing filed on you. Like I said, the FBI is backing away. So is IAD. For now."
"So I am back in."
"You're back in. Not my choice. Just so you know, they went over me because I told them to blow it out their collective asses. Something about this stinks, but I guess that will have to wait for later. For now, you are on detached assignment. You're working with them until further notice."
"What about Edgar?"
"Don't worry about Edgar. He's not your concern anymore."
"Pounds, you act like you did me a favor putting me on the homicide table when they kicked me out from Parker Center. I did you the favor, man. So if you're looking for apologies from me, you aren't getting any."
"Bosch, I'm not looking for anything from you. You fucked yourself. Only problem with that is that you may have fucked me in the process. If it was up to me, you wouldn't be near this case. You'd be checking pawn shop lists."
"But it isn't up to you, is it?" He hung up before Pounds could reply. He stood there thinking for a few moments, and his hand was still on the phone when it rang again. "What?"
"Rough day, right?"
Eleanor Wish said. "I thought it was somebody else."
"Well, I guess you've heard."
"I heard."
"You'll be working with me."
"How come you called off the dogs?"
"Simple. We want to keep the investigation out of the papers."
"Ah, there's more to it." She didn't say anything, but she didn't hang up. Finally, he thought of something to say. "Tomorrow, what do I do?"
"Come see me in the morning. We'll go from there."
Bosch hung up. He thought about her, and about how he didn't know what was going on. He didn't like it, but he couldn't walk away now. He went into the kitchen and took the bottle of Old Nick from the refrigerator. Lewis stood with his back to the passing traffic, using his wide body to block the sound from intruding into the payphone.
"He starts with the FBI, the Bureau, tomorrow morning," Lewis said. "What do you want us to do?"
Irving didn't answer at first. Lewis envisioned him on the other end of the line, jaw worked into a clench. Popeye face, Lewis thought, and smirked. Clark walked over from the car then and whispered, "What's so funny? What did he say?" Lewis batted him away and made a "don't bother me" face at his partner.
"Who is that?"
Irving asked.
"It was Clark, sir. He's just anxious to know our assignment."
"Did Lieutenant Pounds talk to the subject?"
"Yes, sir,"
Lewis said, wondering if Irving was taping the call.
The lieutenant said the subject had been told he is to work with the Bureau. They are consolidating the murder and the bank investigations. He is working with Special Agent Eleanor Wish.
What's his scam?
Irving said, though no reply was expected or offered by Lewis. There was silence on the phone line for a while, because Lewis knew better than to interrupt Irving's thoughts. He saw Clark approaching the phone booth again, and he waved him away and shook his head, as if he were dealing with an impetuous child. The doorless phone booth was at the bottom of Woodrow Wilson Drive, next to the Barham Boulevard crossing over the Hollywood Freeway. Lewis heard the sound of a semi thunder by on the freeway and felt warm air blow into the booth. He looked up at the lights of the houses on the hillside and tried to pinpoint which one came from Bosch's stilt house. It was impossible to tell. The hill looked like a giant, fat Christmas tree with too many lights.
He must have some kind of leverage on them. He's muscled his way into it. I'll tell you what your next assignment is. You two stay on him. Not so he knows, but stay with him. He is up to something. Find out what. And build your 1.81 case along the way. The Federal Bureau of Investigation may have withdrawn its complaint, but we will not back off.
What about Pounds? You still want him copied?
That is Lieutenant Pounds, Detective Lewis. And yes, copy him your daily surveillance log. That will be enough for him.
Irving hung up without another word.
Very good, sir,
Lewis said to the dead phone. He didn't want Clark to know he had been slighted.
We'll stay with it.
Thank you, sir.
Good night.
Then he, too, hung up, privately embarrassed that his commander had not deemed it necessary to say good night to him. Clark quickly walked up. So?
So we pick him up again tomorrow morning. Bring your piss bottle.
That's it? Just surveillance?
At this time?
Shit. I want to search that fucker's house. Break some stuff. He's probably got the shit from that heist sitting up there.
If he was involved, I doubt he would be so stupid. We sit back for now. If he's dirty on this, we'll see.
Oh, he's dirty. Don't worry.
We'll see.
Sharkey sat on the concrete block wall that fronted a parking lot on Santa Monica Boulevard. He closely watched the lighted front of the 7-Eleven across the street, checking out who was coming and who was going. Mostly tourist trade and couples. No singles yet. None that fit the bill. The boy called Arson sauntered over and said,
"This ain't going nowhere, Boudreau."
Arson's hair was red and waxed into spiky flames. He wore black jeans and a dirty black T-shirt. He was smoking a Salem. He wasn't stoned, but he was hungry. Sharkey looked at him and then passed him to where the third boy, the one known as Mojo, sat on the ground near the bikes. Mojo was shorter and wider, with his black hair slicked back in a knob behind his head. Acne scars marked his face forever as sullen.
"Give it a few more minutes," Sharkey said. "I want to eat, man,"
Arson said.
"Well, what do you think I'm trying to do? We all want to eat."
"Maybe we could see how Betty Jane's doing," Mojo said. "She'll have made enough for us to eat."
Sharkey looked over at him and said,
"You two go ahead. I'm staying till I score. I'm going to eat."
As he said this, he watched the maroon Jaguar XJ6 pull into the convenience store's lot.
"How about the guy in the pipe?"
Arson asked.
"You think they found him yet? We could go up there and check him out, see if there is any bread. I don't know why you didn't have the balls to do it last night, Shark."
"Hey, you go up there by yourself and check it out if you want," Sharky said. "See who has balls then."
He hadn't told them that he had called 911 about the body. That would be harder for them to forgive than his fear of going into the pipe. A lone man got out of the Jaguar. He looked like late 30s, brush cut, baggy white slacks and shirt, sweater draped around his shoulders. Sharkey saw no one waiting in the car.
"Hey, check out the Jag," he said.
The other two looked over at the store.
"This is it. I'm going."
"We'll be here," Arson said.
Sharkey got off the wall and trotted across the boulevard. He watched the Jag's owner through the windows of the store. He had an ice cream in his hand and was looking at the magazine rack. His eyes were constantly on the prowl as he looked at the other man in the store. Sharkey was encouraged as he saw the man head toward the counter to pay for the ice cream. He squatted against the front of the store, the grill of the Jag 4 feet away.
When the man came out, Sharkey waited for their eyes to lock and the man to smile before he spoke up.
"Hey, mister,"
he said as he got up.
"I was wondering if you could do me a favor."
The man looked around the parking lot before answering.
"Sure. What do you need?"
"Well, I was wondering if you might go in and get me a beer. I'll give you the money and all. I just want a beer to relax, you know?"
The man hesitated.
"Oh, I don't know. That would be illegal, wouldn't it? You're not 21. I could get in trouble."
"Well,"
Sharkey said with a smile,
"do you have any beer at home? Then you wouldn't have to be buying it. Just giving somebody a beer ain't no crime."
"Well,
I wouldn't stay long. We could probably relax each other a little bit, you know?"
The man took another look around the parking lot. No one was watching. Sharkey thought he had him now.
"Okay," he said. "I can take you back here later if you want."
"Sure, that'd be cool."
They drove east on Santa Monica to Flores and then south a couple of blocks to a townhouse development. Sharkey never turned around or tried to look in the mirrors. They would be back there. He knew it. There was a security gate on the outside of the property which the man had a key for and pulled closed behind them. Then they went into his townhouse.
"My name is Jack," the man said.
"What can I get you?"
"I'm Phil. Do you have any food? I'm kind of hungry, too."
Sharkey looked around for the security intercom and the button that would unlatch the gate. The apartment was mostly light-colored furniture on an off-white, deep-pile carpet.
"Nice place."
"Thanks. Let me see what I have. If you want to wash your clothes, we can get that done, too, while you're here. I don't do this very often, you know, but when I can help someone, I try."
Sharkey followed him into the kitchen. The security console was on the wall next to the phone. When Jack opened the refrigerator and bent down to look in, Sharkey pushed the button that opened the gate outside. Jack didn't notice.
"I have tuna fish, and I can make a salad.
How long have you been on the street?"
"I'm not going to call you Phil. If you don't want to tell me your real name, that's fine."
Tuna fish would be good. Not too long."
"Are you clean?"
"Yeah, sure, I'm okay."
"We'll take precautions."
It was time. Sharkey stepped backward into the hall. Jack looked up from the refrigerator, a plastic bowl in his hand, his mouth slightly ajar. Sharkey thought there was a look of recognition in his face, like he knew what was about to happen. Sharkey twisted the deadbolt and opened the door. Arson and Mojo walked in.
"Hey, what is this?"
Jack said, though there was no confidence in his voice. He rushed into the hall, and Arson, who was the biggest of all four of them, hit him with a fist on the bridge of his nose. There was a sound like a pencil breaking, and the plastic bowl of tuna fish clumped to the ground. Then there was a lot of blood on the off-white carpet. Part 3. Tuesday, May 22nd. Eleanor Wish called again Tuesday morning while Harry Bosch was fiddling with his tie in front of the bathroom mirror. She said she wanted to meet at a coffee shop in Westwood before taking him into the bureau. He had already had two cups of coffee, but said he'd be there. He hung up, fastened the top button on his white shirt, and pulled the tie snugly to his neck. He couldn't remember the last time he had paid such attention to the details of his appearance. When he got there, she was in one of the booths along the front windows. She had both hands on the water glass in front of her and looked content. There was a plate pushed off to the side that had the paper wrapping from a muffin on it. She gave him a short, courtesy smile as he slid in and waved a hand at a waitress.
"Just coffee," Bosch said.
"You already ate?"
Wish said when the waitress went away.
No, but I'm fine."
"You don't eat much, I can tell."
Said more like a mother than a detective.
"So, who's going to tell me about it, you or Rourke?"
"Me."
The waitress put down a cup of coffee. Bosch could hear four salesmen in the next booth dickering over the table's breakfast bill. He took a small swallow of hot coffee.
"I would like the FBI's request for my help put on paper, signed by the senior special agent in charge of the Los Angeles office."
She hesitated a moment, put her glass down and looked directly at him for the first time. Her eyes were so dark they betrayed nothing about her. At the corners, he saw just the beginning of a gentle web of lines in the tan skin. At the line of her chin, there was a small, white crescent scar, very old and almost unnoticeable. He wondered if the scar and the lines bothered her, as he believed they would most women. Her face seemed to him to have a slight sadness cast in it,
as if a mystery carried inside had worked its way outside. Perhaps it was fatigue, he thought. Nevertheless, she was an attractive woman. He figured her age for early 30s.
"I think that can be arranged," she said. "Any other demands before we get to work?"